Now we're going to shift gears somewhat, having looked at the institution of corporate media, how that operates, how that's constituted. We're going to look now at the messages that that is used to broadcast. And we've looked at the fact that it's not legally obliged to tell truth, that you can lie by omission. But I'm going to try and look a little deeper now to look at misleading concepts, the way that language, because it assists us in framing a discussion, can also be used to mislead us. So, as one example, picking up from that comment back from 2001, this idea about terrorism, if you say, well, terrorists are evil, we are counter-terrorists, then one would assume, on a basic level, then we are the good guys. So that is quite a lot to assume before we have looked at the operations of what is a terrorist or what is a counter-terrorist on the ground. I'm going to be trying to avoid all use of these plastic phrases, these phrases which are high in emotional content and low in denotation. They are ways to mislead an audience and to prevent clear thinking about what's going on. There are a range of ways that concepts are introduced. Very commonly it happens through language. So a new phrase is introduced with an explanation of what it means and where it fits. For example, radicalization or non-violent extremism. Old guy that I am, I remember a time before these words were common currency. And one of the first steps that I do in trying to document this changing language is to use Google Trends. And if you type in a phrase, it will give you a graph of how commonly that phrase has been searched for on Google search engine, and they have data going back to 2005. So of particular interest are phrases which are almost never searched for, and then suddenly there's a huge spike, which is when corporate media started to use this phrase, and people are saying, ooh, what's domestic extremism? And they type it into a search engine to try and get an explanation. So the internet being what it is, it's then pretty easy to go back and say, right, okay, so these newspapers were using that phrase to describe this event, and it is very commonly a so-called terrorist event, a bombing, typically, one which doesn't lead to a legal trial, but which leads to a supposed perpetrator who has killed himself or been killed by police. There's about a dozen or so words and phrases that I'm aware of that have been used post 9/11 to facilitate the rollback of civil liberties and the subverting of human rights to corporate rights. The general pattern is this: people are scared with enemy images into acquiescing. Politicians are instructed to put forward laws which include these phrases. So you have a law against terrorism or against non-violent extremism. And whilst people in their minds, through the corporate media, associate these words with terribly heinous, scary behaviour, they think, well, okay, that's only going to apply to them, not us. These laws get written in legal stone. Of course, the laws don't need changing if the words have meanings which are ready to be changed. So the law is passed, people thinking that that phrase means one thing, and when it's operationalized, then the interpretation of the word, because it's a plastic word, effectively moves the law in another direction, to the point where, for example, I was threatened under anti-terror legislation by a policeman because I was waiting for my wife outside the toilets at an airport, and this was deemed to be suspicious behaviour. So that does also set of phrases which are in use now to facilitate cracking down on free speech is uppermost in my mind because I'm researching that at the moment. But we're actually going to look at concepts which transcend any particular phrase. And these are concepts, some of them have been operational for centuries, and one in particular for millennia, to mislead people, to hide the real world under a matrix reality. Now, if you're a long-time listener, you may be already thinking, what concept could that be that's been running for thousands of years and has been blinding people to the truth? Well, there's a range I could suggest, but the one that I will be focusing on in particular, as I suspect you'll be aware if you're a long-time listener, is money. Money is a substitute for wealth, one that can be easily described in figures, tossed around by economists, and seems to be replacing the real world, real wealth, used as a matrix to cover over the reality.
Corporations ran the real business of empire while government leaders fabricated noble excuses for the wars that were required to keep that business going. Matrix reality was about patriotism, national honor, and heroic causes. True reality was on another plane altogether, that of economics.
The powers that be couldn't make jingoistic appeals to national honor if the public hadn't already been seeded, if they weren't prepared to see their nation as separate from other nations. If they saw all the people of the world on a level, they wouldn't tolerate the idea that slavery is all right for them because they are different from us. Corporate media comes out with this sort of stuff all the time and makes a rich appeal to these concepts. And we all understand them, whether or not we consciously do so, whether we use them ourselves. So, for example, if a corporate media announcer says, "We have attacked Iraq," and you don't immediately stop and think, "Hey, that's funny because she's still there in the studio and I haven't attacked Iraq, so neither of us has." In fact, because we know that corporate media, when they say something like that, they're expecting us to identify with young people who are sent out as members of military forces, and these days quite commonly private military forces rather than national military forces, but somehow still at a national behest. So the idea that wars happen between different nation states, it's something that we're all aware of, and increasingly, I think it's a highly misleading way of looking at things. But first, let's hear Michael Parenti on the phrase "we" and its use by corporate media.
Maybe the confusion is in using this word "we." We don't make this policy, they do. And the policy isn't stupid, it's remarkably successful and brutal for their interests. It's stupid to us, it doesn't do anything for us. It's cost us money, it doesn't give us anything but wars and tribulations and all. But it's very useful for they. So maybe we should stop saying we do this and we go there. It's a very rational policy to support governments that are open to U.S. corporate interests and to oppose or overthrow governments, be they communist or populist or whatever, that have some measure of independent development and some measure of redistribution of surplus value. Even a country like Iraq, even a country like Libya. Those who keep saying we might often fall into the mistake of treating the nation as the basic unit of analysis in international affairs. Sometimes it is, but often it isn't. Even sometimes in simple nation-state territorial rivalries, the issues are defined by political economic elites who are less likely to serve the interests of the general populace and more likely to define their own interests as the general interest. And every time you say we, they love it. You're playing right into their hands.
An obvious but I think, very important piece of advice there from Michael Parenti, is not to use these concepts and not to use the associated language. If we don't subscribe to the concomitant worldview, then let's make a conscious effort not to promulgate it. So, for example, when I meet somebody, I tend not to ask them, what do you do for a living? As in, what you do and you get paid for is somehow the most important defining factor, and I need to know that first. No, there's lots of things that people do, maybe not very many that they get paid for, and I'm not going to attribute specific importance to one because of moving of pieces of paper or numbers in a bank account. Another concept that I am suspicious about, and I think is very misleading, is this concept that nation states are, in some sense, fundamental and defining, or indeed are anything more than a piece of legacy social technology which is being exploited by the powers that be as a kind of divide and conquer mechanism. The best summary I could find about this was a famous speech from a 1970s film, The Network.
You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There are no Russians. There are no Arabs. There are no third worlds. There is no West. There is only one holistic system of systems. One vast and immane, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational dominion of dollars. Petrodollars, electrodollars, multidollars, Reichmarks, rands, rubles, pounds, and shekels. It is the international system of currency which determines the totality of life on this planet. That is the natural order of things today.
Now, the nation is only one such fiction. I see money, business, economics as part of another complex of illusion that's used to abridge thought about the real world. We're going to get on to that, particularly how the use of business and accounting practices can suppress feelings of right and wrong. And The Network again illustrates how effectively the nature of global business has the ability to condense all aspects of life down to purely financial calculation and selfish maximization in particular.
You get up on your little 21-inch screen and howl about America and democracy. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today. What do you think the Russians talk about in their councils of state? Karl Marx? They get out their linear programming charts, statistical decision theories, min-max solutions, and compute the price-cost probabilities of their transactions and investments, just like we do. We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies, Mr. Beale. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime. And our children will live, Mr. Beale, to see that perfect world.
The market's money price system always optimally allocates resources and distributes goods and services in each and every society to ensure the best of all possible worlds.
In which there's no war or famine, oppression or brutality. one vast and ecumenical holding company for whom all men will work to serve a common profit, in which all men will hold a share of stock. All necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized.
Now, I wonder what the producers of the network would have thought of today's corporate media environment, which, under huge consolidation and globalization, is closer than ever to the media landscape depicted in that film. Another fraudulent concept, extremism, as if people sat on a spectrum somewhere, a one-dimensional view, and in the middle, well, that's fairly safe territory. Out at either end, well, those are dangerous extremes. This concept is one that's promulgated by the self-styled mainstream media, which I looked at in episode 672, Mainstream or Extreme, which instead suggested that corporate media was the tool of a tiny minority of people with a very polarizing and money-centered view of the world. So the staff from those organizations, if you check the qualifications, that's written testimony, evidence that they have spent years memorizing material given to them in the so-called education system, which has attempted to create a false layer of reality, attempted to block out the real world and deeper thoughts with a more superficial level of doctrine, dogma, an official narrative and a set of beliefs about the importance of this zero-sum phenomenon, finance. We're going to get on to how money affects people's morality, how it affects their worldview. But the key point to note is the decisions made by those in the corporate media are money-centered. They wouldn't be in those jobs if they weren't that focused on money. Is there anything terribly surprising about the suggestion that people within the system's so-called positions of power make selfish decisions to maximize their own utility? This is, after all, what economic models would predict. I'm going to suggest that, yes, they do use government apparatus, they do, where they can, collaborate and sometimes control pieces of national government machinery where it's available. And I don't think there's anything new in this. I think the new thing is the extent to which it goes on, the way that they're now globalized. There's more or less one supranational deep state, yes, within fighting, but the economic polarization is more extreme than it was. For a reminder of a century ago that the same sort of things were going on, covert control of governments by private individuals and organizations for their own benefits. Let's hear from episode 641.
By the 1920s, we see an article, The Nation magazine, called The Republic of Brown Brothers, and this was about a bank that would later be, one of its partners would be Prescott Bush, the grandfather of George W. Bush, and how they were using the U.S. government, particularly, for example, the military, the Marines, what have you, to go into various countries where the financial interests of private corporations were threatened and essentially neutralize or even remove governments.
So if nation states are something of a fiction, what about national borders? As somebody who's lived in various different countries throughout my life, I've spent a lot of time satisfying officialdom by keeping my rectangles in order, fulfilling requirements about visa stamps and passports, and Lynn and I are on the same page on this. This is what she had to say from episode 327.
It seems strange to me that all of a sudden immigration has been trumpeted as such a big problem that Congress feels compelled to use taxpayer money, including the taxes paid by immigrants, to build walls across the U.S. borders. This in the wake of a group of armed racists calling themselves the Minutemen, patrolling the southern border, hoping to accost people crossing from Mexico.
521.
The Minutemen don't merely deride, but also aim to shore up state power, and what's more, the state turns out to be a willing partner with this outlaw group. Significantly, atop the fence that the Minutemen built, the vigilante group mounted video cameras for spotting illegal immigrants, cameras that stream directly to the Nogales dispatch offices of the Border Patrol.
I call them racists because they aren't patrolling the Canadian border, where presumably only Anglos would be crossing. And thus I conclude that they are motivated not by issues of law and undocumented immigration per se, just the immigration of Latinos who are fast becoming a majority culture in the Southwest. It's important to understand that immigration laws have long had the purpose to control the ethnic composition and cultural character of the United States. These laws were at one point directed against people from various European countries who were considered undesirable. Here's an example from my own family. Both my parents were immigrants who came here as children from various countries. My mother had come here alone as a refugee from the fascists in Italy. My grandmother was not allowed a visa to immigrate here. Why? She was born in Hungary, so she was considered a Hungarian, and the quota for Hungarians was filled. So she spent World War II hiding in an attic, going out only at night, posing as a deaf-mute beggar.
There's no such thing as illegal human beings, and there's no such thing as illegal immigrants. Instead, there are illegal states and inhumane policies.
He was just 15, he was a new trainee. He lied about it for the opportunity to defend the border, his life was sworn. Not a generation was native born.
Johnny Jingle. I have no use for sanctimonious utterances on the subject of legal versus illegal immigration.
Johnny Jingle. He had lost the battle but won the war.
This is all one planet, and people should be able to migrate where they wish or where they must. But controlling the movements of populations, keeping them in or keeping them out, is just one of the ways that privileged groups use nation-states and their borders to maintain an oppressive human hierarchy.
Jingle, don't you fight for me. Jingle, don't you speak for me. Jingle, don't you fight for me. Jingle, don't you speak for me.
To the man who owns the land, we're all the same. But when his grip begins to slip, then he'll be calling out your name.
They stir up witch hunts against defenseless groups that are made into scapegoats, and thus deflect anger from the rulers.
And the throne, the pulpit, and the politician. Jingle, don't you speak for me. Create a thirst for power in the common man. Jingle, don't you speak for me.
Immigrants or other identifiable minorities have repeatedly served this role. The Jews of Germany, who Hitler purged as some dangerous alien influence, had been in the land now called Germany since at least the Roman Empire, a couple of millennia before Hitler was born. And the Mexicans' native ancestors have been here in Turtle Island for tens of thousands of years before the ancestors of the Minutemen arrived on these shores from Europe. In previous chapters of the reading I've been doing from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, he explained how the developers of compulsory state schooling wanted to impose certain cultural values, those of Anglo-Saxon Protestants, on the children of immigrants in order to prevent challenges to the existing order.
545.
Speaking and writing English had very little to do with work on a Ford assembly line. But Ford decided to make English language classes compulsory. The first thing foreign-speaking Ford employees learned to say, quote, "I am a good American," close quote. Ford students were graduated in a musical extravaganza that bears close attention as an indicator of the American spiritual climate after World War I. A huge black pot took up the middle of the stage, from which hung a large sign that read, "Melting Pot." From backstage, an endless procession of costumed immigrants descended into the pot on a ladder reaching into its bowels. Each wore a sign identifying his former homeland. Simultaneously, from either side of the pot, two other streams of men emerged, now converted into real Americans, dressed in identical clothing. Each waved a small American flag, while a brass band played "America the Beautiful" fortissimo. Wives and children cheered wildly when the cue cards were flashed.
710. Conflicts between nation states. Whilst they're still important factors in people's minds and they dominate public discourse and world politics, if what we've been learning about the deep state is in fact true, then a good proportion of them are in fact no more than orchestrated distractions from the real action, often on another plane altogether. So just as a piece of anecdotal information, I travelled sometimes to South Korea, and British friends, when I went there, were very worried. Good heavens, that's right next to North Korea, aren't you worried about being nuked? And in my experience, I found no one there in South Korea who was worried about the North Korean prospect. So people's perceptions of danger are really subject to heavy-duty manipulation, pre-setting, if you like. People will be worried about whatever is being shown to them by corporate media time in, time out. And the South Koreans in those days were very worried about exploding telephones, because they all had smartphones, and you see one or two of those exploding, you look at that on TV and you think, good heavens, am I carrying a bomb around? So that illustrates how easily people's emotions can be manipulated. And just as the depth of these concepts goes back hundreds or thousands of years, goes back to a time when people from other nation states had really different lives, and they looked different, smelt different, spoke different languages. Now it seems to me the homogenizing effects of global corporate capitalism have to some extent undermined nationality as a great divide and conquer tool. People have got to be shown a lot of sporting events, a lot of people waving rectangular pieces of cloth in order to try to preserve nationality as an important concept in people's minds. So if people are using differences between nations as a means of making money, then to what extent are they in the real world? Well, they're the functionaries. There's a lot of people profiting from the war on terror, using people's emotions to make money out of things, but this is not the reality. The economy itself is a fiction. The longer we spend thinking about rectangles, the less we appreciate the real world. Let's hear Michael Parenti on that from episode 4.
Not only economic policy doesn't happen, the economy itself just doesn't happen. I mean, the economy, what is the economy? You ever think? I mean, strictly speaking, there's no such thing as the economy. Nobody has ever seen an economy. You cannot touch or see or feel an economy. What you can see are people engaged in exchange of values in productive labor and in not such productive labor. And we take all these different actualities and activities and we take them together and we form what is called a hypothetical construct, and we abstract from that and we call that the economy. It's a hypothetical construct, abstracted from observable actualities. Now, our abstractions are very powerful things. Like other abstractions, this one becomes a reified entry. You see, first you abstract from the reality, and then you endow it with a mechanical reality or motive of its own, sort of a conceptual Jurassic Park or something like that. So now we talk about the economy as a self-generating force. The problems of the economy, not the problems of capitalism, not the problems of what the corporations are doing to us, but the problems of the economy. The economy becomes an entity of its own. So we hear statements like, the economy is in a slump. The economy is in the doldrums. You get the image of this big, bulky, moody economy. The economy is making a comeback like a sports hero. The one that always catches my attention. The economy is acting funny. We do the same thing with the whole concept of nation. It's reified and abstracted. What the nation does, what the United States does this, and the United States does that, and we do this, and we get ourselves into that. So we are reifying even when we say we. We should start asking when we hear one of our leaders or our media pundits say, our interests necessitate this action, or we're looking out for U.S. interests, what are U.S. interests? By the way, that question first started to intrigue me back in 1967. I was writing my first book, and I was a postdoctoral fellow at Yale University, and I sat in the Sterling Memorial Library, and I went through about 30 volumes of the Department of State bulletins. I mean, huge volumes of these bulletins. You know what I was looking for? I was looking for what U.S. interests were. It was the height of the Vietnam War, and all I kept hearing about was our interests, U.S. interests. So I said, I gotta find out what these interests are. And I went through these volumes day after day. I remember the librarian said, what are you looking for? I notice you don't take any notes. You keep getting volume 10, 11, 12, 14, 107, and I'm going through looking for, finally I came across one instance of U.S. interest. It was very interesting. When it was mentioned that U.S. presence would be taken as a U.S. interest. You see, so we said, it is in our interest to maintain a presence in that area. What I found was William Bundy, State Department official, said, it is in our interest to maintain our military bases in the Philippines. I said, I came off my seat. Here it is, U.S. interest, I'm going to find out, finally, is to maintain these bases. Now that's very interesting, because normally you would have thought the bases were there to maintain U.S. interests. But now we hear U.S. interest is to maintain the basis. The instrumental value becomes its own end value, a common thing in human thought and all that.
I think Michael Parenti's hit upon another important point there, a step in the development of this counterproductivity, a confusion between means and ends. The basis, until I listened to Unwelcome Guests, were completely new to me. I had no idea that the U.S. had a massive investment in military preparedness, controlling vast numbers of bases around the world. So let's hear Lynn Gehry speaking about that on episode 167, which really opened my eyes to an important topic that had been hidden from me by corporate media.
The U.S. maintains a vast global military empire with bases in more than 120 countries. This empire is maintained in conjunction with a few very large private corporations whose income comes almost exclusively from military contracts. This state of affairs has wide-reaching impact on our domestic policies and arrangements that are seldom examined or even acknowledged. The collective deep pocket that pays the bill for this military-industrial complex, as former President Dwight Eisenhower termed it, is the average American taxpayer. and she has little idea of what is being spent or how it's being used. The military and its bottom line seem to be above criticism. Both political parties in Congress fall over themselves to fling the taxpayers' money at what is euphemistically called defense. The Republicans and the increasingly look-alike Democrats decry big government while they shovel the national treasure into the maw of the military machine. There is never a shortage of funds to control people at home with police and prisons, or to dominate the rest of the world's people with the largest military in the history of the world. But, we are told, Social Security is too expensive, and free medical care, free education for all through college, cleaning up our polluted lands, or converting the country to renewable energy is unaffordable.
706. When are terrorists not terrorists?
In the U.S. today, 59 cents of every federal discretionary tax dollar goes to the Pentagon to fund the cancerous war machine. Our communities have become addicted to military spending as our physical and social infrastructure continues to deteriorate. There is virtually no money for anything else these days as we witness austerity cuts in social programs here in this country and all around the globe. The Pentagon says that America's role under corporate globalization of the world economy will be security export. We won't have conventional jobs making useful things in our communities. Instead, we will build weapons for endless war and send our kids overseas to die on behalf of oil corporations. In fact, today, weapons are the number one industrial export product of the U.S. And when weapons are your number one industrial export product, what is your global marketing strategy for that product line? What does it say about the soul of our nation that we have to keep selling weapons and killing people around the globe in order to provide jobs for workers so they can feed their families? Increasingly, the only real job investment money coming into Maine and across the nation from the federal government is for military weapons production. So now nearly 10% of Maine's economy is reliant on weapons contracts. We began the walk up in the beautiful mountains and lake region called Rangeley, where the Pentagon's Missile Defense Agency is considering putting up to 60 so-called missile defense interceptors, which in fact are key elements in U.S. first strike attack planning and are aimed at Russia and China. Narrow winding roads would have to be bulldozed and widened, and huge holes would have to be blasted into the mountains in order to insert the missile silos. Toxic fuel would be trucked in and stored on site, the same rocket fuel that is now contaminating water sources in 22 states across the nation. The whole plan would be an environmental disaster and would cost taxpayers more than $4 billion. This program is an important illustration of how our nation increasingly puts blind trust and faith in space technology to fight modern wars. Come to find out, the Pentagon didn't even want this expensive program, but pressure on Congress from the Boeing Corporation forced it to go forward with an environmental impact statement process in public hearings in four states, including Maine, to select an East Coast deployment site for the missile defense base. Another major weapons program being built that the Pentagon didn't actually want is also in Bath, Maine, where I live. General Dynamics Corporation owns Bath Iron Works, where the destroyers for the Navy are built. The standard destroyer previously cost $1.5 billion each and is outfitted with another version of these missile defense interceptor missiles, which have had much success in their testing program. But after Obama became president, he forced the Pentagon to build the new high-tech stealth destroyer that they call the Zumwalt class destroyer, the job of which is to sneak up on China and blast it with an electromagnetic railgun and other weapon systems. This is part of Obama's pivot of 60% of U.S. military forces into the Asia Pacific to provocatively confront and control China. As it turns out, the majority stockholders of the General Dynamics Corporation are the Crown family in Chicago, who helped Obama get elected to the presidency. So we owed them. And the new Zumwalt stealth destroyer, at a cost to taxpayers of between $4 to $6 billion per copy, is their reward. As part of the U.S. pivot to China, the Pentagon needs more airfields for warplanes, more barracks for troops, and more ports of call for ships being deployed into the Asia Pacific. So in places like Jeju Island, South Korea, we see a 500-year-old farming and fishing culture being torn apart, and UNESCO-recognized World Heritage soft coral reefs just offshore being destroyed as a Navy base is being built for U.S. nuclear subs, aircraft carriers, and the destroyers made in my hometown of Bath. Endangered coral reefs in the Philippines, Australia, Hawaii, Okinawa, and other places are similarly being severely impacted by U.S. military expansion across the region. The global network is working hard to build international support for the local struggles against U.S. military devastation of the environment and the way of life in these communities. The Pentagon has the largest carbon footprint on the planet today. But sadly, there is little acknowledgement of that fact by most climate change groups, which well illustrates, I believe, the off-limits nature of the growing military domination of our society. Some environmental leaders have told me over the years that they don't want to negatively impact their positive working relationship with Democrats in Congress by taking on the more controversial military issues, which most Democrats fully support because they bring jobs to their districts. We've become an occupied nation. The corporate oligarchy that runs the show in Washington uses space-based technologies to spy on us and to direct all warfare on the planet. In a way, you could call today's expensive military satellites the triggers that make the high-tech weapons like drones and missiles work. These satellites allow the military to see everything on the Earth, to hear everything on the Earth, and to target virtually every place on the planet. The military-industrial complex has become the primary resource extraction service for corporate capitalism and is preparing the future generations for its dead-end street of endless war. In the U.S., approximately 40% of all scientists, engineers, and technical professionals currently work in the military sector. This is a colossal waste of talent and intellectual resources as we face the coming reality of climate change. Due to the fiscal crisis across the nation, engineering, computer science, mathematics, astronomy, and chemistry departments in colleges and universities have become increasingly dependent on military funding. We're sold the line that high-tech robotic warfare will save American lives and will be a cheaper way to fight. One key reason for the militarization of space is also as a resource extraction strategy so that they can go out to the planetary bodies and get the precious resources that we're running out of back here at home on the Earth. And to do this, they say they need nuclear power in space. They need it for mining the sky. International space law is now being rewritten to allow corporate control of the planetary bodies. The plan is to scrap the United Nations moon and outer space treaties so that the corporations can claim private ownership of the planetary bodies. Rovers on Mars today are powered with plutonium-238. In 1989, in 1990, and then again in 1997, I organized campaigns at the Kennedy Space Center to protest and try to block launches of these radioactive plutonium launches into space. And today we hear space entrepreneur Elon Musk say that we've got to move our civilization to Mars. And in fact, the organization called the Mars Society says the Earth is a rotting, dying, stinking planet, and we have to move our civilization to Mars. Imagine the cost of doing that. The militarization of everything around us is indeed a spiritual sickness. Lakota Holy Man Lame Deer, many years ago, talked about the green frog skin, the dollar bill, and how the white man was blinded by his love for the paper money. His spiritual connection to the Mother Earth was broken. In 1877, the great Lakota warrior Crazy Horse was brought onto the reservation in South Dakota as the Indian Wars came to an end. Along with the end of the Civil War just 12 years before, the military-industrial complex at the time saw an end to its massive war profits. It needed an enemy to keep the production lines going. So a strategy was developed. Journalists and artists were paid to fabricate stories saying that Crazy Horse had broken out of the reservation and was going back on the warpath, killing innocent civilians, children, white children, raping white women, and burning their houses to the ground. These stories were printed in major newspapers across the nation, and the American people were outraged and afraid, and they called upon Congress to do something about it. And of course, Congress complied, swung into action, and appropriated more money for weapons production, while Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull sat inside their teepees on the reservation without a gun to their name. Similarly, in our times, we've seen the military-industrial complex fabricate stories about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And today we see ISIS, which has been trained, armed, funded, and directed by the CIA and Saudi Arabia as the justification for the U.S. to get back into Iraq and to bomb Syria. With so many communities now across the nation addicted to military spending, we need a transitional strategy to deal with the jobs issue, because literally we as a people, as a movement in this country, are held hostage by this jobs issue, as so many people now and so many communities are dependent on military production.
29. Propaganda and control of the public mind.
The way the system is designed, technology is developed under the guise of the military and then handed over to private power when it works. Now, that's true of everything. Airplanes, computers, the internet, you name it.
Now, this is Eisenhower's Cross of Iron speech. It's new material on the show, although I did play a couple of excerpts from this for episode 700, Is There No Other Way the World May Live? A welcome reminder that U.S. presidents have not always been firmly behind the perpetual war machine, and so, by implication, that one day they may come to support the cause of peace, even if we never hear things like this nowadays from the so-called political leaders.
A life of perpetual fear and tension, a burden of arms draining the wealth and labor of all people, a wasting of strength that defies the American system or the Soviet system or any system to achieve true abundance and happiness for the peoples of this earth. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is 2 electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is 2 fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is, I repeat, the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. These plain and cruel truths define the peril and point the hope that come with the spring of 1953. This is one of those times in the affairs of nations when the gravest choices must be made if there is to be a turning toward a just and lasting peace. It is a moment that calls upon the governments of the world to speak their intentions with simplicity and with honesty. It calls upon them to answer the question that stirs the hearts of all sane men. Is there no other way the world may live?
I'm going to come back to that question because I think it is so important. We have people who have spent years trying to tackle military overproduction, people who are seeking security by making other people insecure, selfishness, if you like. People saying things like they are dependent on military production. If people are held hostage by the system, then it does behove us not to fall in love with our hostage taker. We must avoid the Stockholm syndrome. It seems to me in the real world that we are dependent upon the environment. We are dependent upon an ability to create food, housing, shelter, to provide these. We can't escape from that. In the real world, we wouldn't need to. But when we think about buying these things, that to me is not in the real world to the same extent. When activists can say things like, we are dependent on military production, that may be the deal as offered by this autonomous social system, but I think we can't, we shouldn't normalize it. We shouldn't say, well, that is the world we live in, let's get used to it. In the real world, we should say, why on earth should I be denied access to food, shelter, place to live, because I am not interested in making weapons of war? Eisenhower's question,
is there no other way the world may live?
Seems to me, yeah, that is absolutely the question. So I reject the implicit, no, there is no other way, from anybody interested in piecemeal reform, in quiet adaptation to the status quo. It seems to me that the system itself is rotten, rests on increasingly shaky, murderous and widely disbelieved foundations. We continue with economic analysis from Lynn Gehry from episode 105.
Poverty in America is growing, yet this is being focused on neither in the news media or in the actions and statements of elected officials. The creation of wealth is often part of the public dialogue, but the creation of poverty is not. Most media outlets are in business to make a profit, and those profits derive wholly from the sales of ads in the case of TV and radio, and significantly from ads in the case of newspapers and magazines. In order to command top dollar ad fees, a publication must demonstrate that it has a sizable audience among people likely to buy the products of the advertiser, people with money. Even non-commercial media, where one would expect these issues to be prioritized, are increasingly catering toward an affluent clientele, and programs on investments are far more common than programs that examine the people whose pink slips are fueling the rise of stock prices. The belief that poverty is a result of the personal failings of an individual or group has been fostered by politicians who have repeatedly framed the debate and ensuing legislation in terms of so-called personal responsibility. This theme has been echoed so relentlessly by corporate media outlets that a sizable number of Americans have been convinced that single teen mothers and alleged welfare queens are the source of the economic difficulties faced by so many hardworking Americans. What is scrupulously avoided in the coverage is the direct relationship between some people's increase in wealth and other people's fall into poverty, a relationship that exposes so-called recent economic booms as really a transfer of wealth from a large group with little money into the hands of a small, already affluent group. To explain this dynamic would shatter the myths about the economic system, and those myths are used to manipulate the electorate into accepting the situation.
We continue with a metaphorical depiction of how perpetual debt stemming from the interest rate keeps people in competition with each other to pay interest to the overlords who run the money system.
I am opposed to the capitalist system because it is an inherently unfair form of social organization that ensures that some people in society will be in a position of degradation, and thus it pits members of society against one another as each fights not to be one of the degraded, and therefore ensures that someone else is. Every gain a person makes must be on someone else's back by design. My mother's childhood friend, Mrs. Bauer, was a prisoner in a Nazi concentration camp. Mrs. Bauer, then a 15-year-old girl, was among 13 female prisoners who were given 12 shovels by the Nazi guards and told to dig holes. They were told that anyone not working would be executed. These prisoners, all previously ordinary, decent people, were forced to fight each other for the privilege of having a shovel, and thus condemning to death one among them, so that they themselves might live. I was 15 years old when I heard this story, the same age as my mother's friend had been when she had been given the choice of killing for a shovel or dying without one. I had heard stories of the Nazi atrocities all my life, but it was not the same as having someone you knew sit before you, show you the numbers on their arm, and tell you such things. The woman in front of me telling me this horrific story was a gracious middle-aged woman with two grown daughters who lived what would be considered a normal, respectable life. My family had just eaten the dinner she cooked for us. I was so horrified by what she told me that I couldn't bring myself to ask her any more questions about it. I just kept thinking, what if it were me? It could have been me. What would I have done? People have argued for centuries over whether human beings are intrinsically good or intrinsically evil. That's the wrong question. Human beings, like other animals, have basic instincts to survive, and on the whole, will respond to whatever situation they find themselves in to do what is necessary to live. What is so wrong about capitalism is that, like the concentration camp example, it puts people in a situation where, in order to survive, they must do so at someone else's expense, and there is no objective reason for things to be that way. I call that an evil system. Competition, winning and losing, may be fine in a game, but life is not a game. The person who loses a competition in life ends up hungry, homeless, or dead. Society as a whole does not benefit by creating losers. But this society likes to pretend the losers don't exist and focus its self-congratulatory propaganda on the wonderful circumstances of the lucky winners. The Nazis in our earlier example had enough shovels for the 13 prisoners. They just held them back because they were sadistic bastards. The capitalists are controlling resources in excess of what they need, which would be more than enough for everyone else. But they are holding them so they can dole them out in an extortionate transaction called the market. What I'm talking about is people who are hoarding resources in excess of what they themselves are actually using. Never mind the 20-room mansion. The owner of the 20-room mansion also owns 3 boarded-up buildings, say, in downtown Washington, D.C. He does not intend to live there, and he has the legal right to make sure that no one else does unless they meet his demands. And I'm not even talking about the sumptuous banquet served at the mansion. I'm talking about the food thrown in the garbage at the end of each day at each of his chain of grocery stores. I'm talking about the piles of goods in stores thrown away each year to make room for the next year's model, in order that no one may live without fighting for a shovel. Every day in America, hungry people rummage through trash bins, looking for food or clothing or other usable items. They are arrested or threatened with arrest by police. I am not aware of any instance where any business or homeowner has been threatened or arrested for throwing away items that others desperately need. Of course they haven't, because they have a legal right to throw food in the garbage. But a hungry person has no legal right in this country to be able to eat. What amazes me about all those people who are very outraged about the right to life of a fetus don't seem to think that anyone actually born has any right to life, since no one can live without adequate food and shelter. I'm a white middle-class person, one of the people with many victories in the shovel war, and I'm angry because in spite of hearing Mrs. Bauer's story, I have essentially been given the same sort of choice. The Limbaugh-esque gas bags who loudly degrade the losers of America's shovel wars like to rationalize a situation by insisting that they, the winners, are somehow more deserving. But the very vehemence and volume of their protestations makes me wonder if somewhere inside they know that they're playing the commandant's game.
319.
Every attitude we have had toward nature has actually been an echo, and even more precisely, a reflection of the attitude we have had toward each other. Our attitudes are entirely a product of our own relationship to each other, our attitudes toward the natural world. But this can be traced back almost to prehistory, to tribal society itself. And we can see the evolution, not only of society, but with society, and along with new and different social relationships, different attitudes toward nature.
I think Murray Bookchin makes a very good point here, one that we should reflect upon, considering what lies at the heart of the current economic system, Homo economicus, which takes it as axiomatic that nobody cares about anybody else, that every single human is an atomic selfish maximizer. I remember how in my first lesson at economics class at university, the lecturer went through the assumptions and I put my hand up and said, well, we know this isn't true because I have people that I care about. So why would we start a theory by assuming something that is provably false? And his reply, as honest as it was uninspiring, is, well, we have to assume this, or we can't do economics. And that was the end of my interest in economics as it's currently practiced. Remember, it was originally called economic science, and it purported to be as objective as other sciences, a study of the world as it exists. My understanding, however, is that it's a cover for plundering done by the people who came up with the theory. So if you can persuade the population in general that everybody is selfish, well, firstly, it gets them fighting each other. It's a divide-and-conquer mechanism, but you already had the money system to do that. Secondly, it excuses the actions of the selfish elite who exploit everyone else. People shrug and say, well, that's human nature. And in my heart of hearts, I know that that's a lie. And Bookchin has helped me to see how that assumption about human nature and what it is to be a human, how that is central to the current ecocidal trajectory of human activity on the planet.
In the medieval world, again, one finds the natural world organized hierarchically, just as medieval society was organized hierarchically. One finds there a king of the beasts because one lives amidst kings. And one finds lowly ants because one lives in a social world built around the labor of lowly serfs.
For some perspective on so-called financial crises, we hear from Nomi Prince. This is new material to the show. She's speaking on the Who, What, Why podcast.
In 1907, there was something called a panic in New York, and it was the equivalent of a financial crisis. And at the time, there was no insured deposits. And some of the smaller banks were doing some very shady trading in copper with each other. They were trying to corner markets. They were trying to sort of, you know, buy it all up and then sort of squeeze the price up and then sort of make a lot of money and come out. People got word of it. Confidence got lost. And there were this, you know, these massive panics throughout New York where people were basically being beaten back by policemen at the time to stay away from the doors of banks when they opened to get their money out and so forth. And so there was a real physical manifestation of fear in the country. And at the time, Teddy Roosevelt, who was the president, was concerned by this. And he had a friend named J.P. Morgan in New York, and he basically allowed J.P. Morgan to decide what should happen. And it was kind of the first history of a bailout in the United States. So the Treasury Department allocated at the time $25 million, not trillions, but, you know, it was a scale thing. And they said to J.P. Morgan, you know, you decide basically where to give this around in the financial system in New York so that you just stop this thing from happening. And so J.P. Morgan got a bunch of his friends together in his library on Fifth Avenue, and he said, okay, how about we just give it to each other, and you know, some of those banks were not particularly friends with anyway, and that's exactly what happened. But the result of that was some banks went under, like a bank called Knickerbocker Trust, which actually dealt with a lot of sort of lower middle class people in New York, went under, and everybody that J.P. Morgan sort of had an association with, all those banks, you know, did quite well. But it was promoted as a sort of like massive win for everybody. The New York Times had J.P. Morgan on a cover as being sort of the king of the country. And Teddy Roosevelt thanked him, and I, you know, all this kind of stuff. And that just started this sort of relationship of sort of abdicating the responsibility of looking at a financial crisis, even from that standpoint, from a strong president, and sort of giving that to the bankers.
As a further illustration of the power balance between the bankers and the government, only a few years after that, the U.S. Federal Reserve was set up, a private monopoly which exists to this day and which profits massively from the so-called U.S. national debt. For an illustration of just how this globalized fiat system exerts huge, unseen, unquestioned influence over elected leaders who are supposed to be in charge, let's turn to episode 595 about privatization in New Zealand.
As soon as Mike Moore conceded a couple of Treasury officials had been driven, apparently, on that particular day to Tikawiti to brief the Prime Minister on this crisis that had been brewing in the background, away from public gaze. And they came to Jim Bolger on election night and said, "Prime Minister, we've got something we really must urgently tell you." And according to the Prime Ministerial aides, Jim Bolger and the aides said, "You'll be joking, sport. Now's the time to party. Come and see us tomorrow." And sure enough, there they were, in their suits, a couple of them, in their dossiers, and very early in the Sunday morning, they briefed the Prime Minister at his home in Tikawiti. Basically, the Bank of New Zealand was on the verge of collapse.
I've controlled myself up to now, but I've got to dive in there. This is very common language, talking about a bank collapse. But if the bank is really on the verge of collapse, then what they needed was some scaffolding to try and shore it up whilst they evacuated the personnel and did something more useful with their lives and shuffle paper around. If it's a fiat currency, they can create money out of nothing. Claims such as, "We're about to have a collapse unless you do X, Y, and Z," seem to me to be very thinly veiled blackmail. And if you can use that sort of blackmail on somebody who's just been elected to power with a mandate from the populace, then to what extent is it actually correct to say that the Prime Minister is in charge?
There have been a considerable blowout in government spending, absolutely unaccounted for in terms of the budgets. And I can remember the Prime Minister must have obviously been quite shaken by this news.
Treasury claimed the crisis was so deep and urgent that only one course of action was possible. Government expenditure had to be slashed across the board. That allowed rapid advancement of the new right agenda. Jim Bolger accepted Treasury's recommendations and appointed Ruth Richardson Minister of Finance.
He looked at our manifesto, which was sitting in the front desk of the caucus room, and he pointed at it and he said, "And we've got some problems with this as well." And I can remember turning to one of my colleagues to my right and saying, "Dear God, we're going to rat. We've only been in for 5 days.
Now, I have no particular knowledge about the New Zealand case, but we've already heard how intelligence agencies are a key component of deep state groups. So it may not have been actually anybody from the Prime Minister's cabinet who leaked those documents. They may just have been obtained by targeted surveillance, by spying, as it used to be called, before it was publicly acknowledged that intelligence agencies were doing this against everybody all the time.
$640 million was lent to the Bank of New Zealand to save it from collapse, and the new government began cutting expenditure.
On budget night, the table to surplus, that is the government's cash position, was projected to be $4.989 billion in the financial year ended 30 June 1991. Today I am announcing a revised projection of $2.556 billion as a surplus.
Treasury and, I guess, the Reserve Bank scared the incoming Prime Minister and Cabinet into taking precipitate action. And it was an action that Ruth Richardson was quite happy to take, after all. Ideologically suited her, and it suited ministers like Upton, Luxton, and Williamson again. But there was no question that Bolger and Birch, who were meant to be holding the strings on Richardson, in the same way I guess that somebody walks a dangerous dog on a leash, there was no question that they felt the situation was so urgent that the dog should be unleashed. So it was.
Now, as I say, I'm no expert on the New Zealand case, but I've seen how the neocon agenda, the privatise everything, the transferring of public authorities and hierarchies to private control, the demand that everything must make a profit, how that was rolled out across the board in the UK and the US and in other countries. And am I stretching your imagination too far to suggest it could have been one group of people who sat and said, "Yeah, let's roll this out in New Zealand as well. We'll get the local guys onto the case." I'm not close to pointing out the names of those people, but I will point out that these structures of organization do exist. Not much talked about, and we'll get on to the Bank of International Settlements later, the central banker's central bank. If you're going to pull this kind of financial blackmail in one country, and it works, then why wouldn't you refine your methods and try it in other places too?
I don't believe that there are any perceptible differences. The approach was the same. The key elements were the same. Hijack, ambush, speed. Before they've got a chance to think, move on to something else, whilst ensuring that the announced package sees completion.
As with any crime, it's important to consider who had the means and the motive, who would benefit, and who was in a position to organise such an event.
The Business Roundtable lobbied hard to keep the revolution going. They used the level of public debt to justify selling public assets and cutting government services.
Ron Trotter, chairman of the Business Roundtable.
We've got to get to the other side of the river. We're in the middle of the river now, and we'll drown if we don't do something about it. We just can't go on borrowing, whether we like it or not. We will find the shutters coming down, and we truly can become a third world country unless we pull ourselves together.
From my experience in the UK, there were a range of motives offered about privatising things, how this was going to suddenly make things much more efficient. But one of the key ones was, now we've started down this road, we have to continue. So it may not look like we're going in a good direction, but trust us, you'll thank us when it's done. We're the experts. So again, it's another instance of fear being used to triumph over any kind of reasoned debate. And what is this guy talking about? New Zealand's going to turn into a third world country.
Unless we pull ourselves together.
And that meant pulling apart the state. The state sector bill dismantled the public service. The public service unions campaigned against the bill.
And the State Sector Act then broke up the rest of the state from a unified state sector into little groups that they could then be dealt with in any way that the government chose. So instead of having to deal with the whole state sector and make changes that way, they could then look at one particular sector of the state sector and make changes to it.
Each department would be run like a private corporation, controlled by a new chief executive.
So they're replacing a locally idiosyncratic group with its own priorities, targets, history, culture, with something that is basically working like a business to facilitate control through money.
That person, in turn, becomes the employing authority for that particular department and can then flow those kinds of appointments on down through the service. That ought to be of concern not only to public servants, but to every citizen in New Zealand. It's a most dangerous bill from a constitutional point of view.
Thousands of public service workers protested in rolling stoppages throughout the country, but the Labour government passed the bill on time and with little change. Government departments could be reviewed and restructured and then reviewed and restructured again. Each change would produce redundancies and a move towards private providers and user pays.
So, end user pays privatizes what it means to be a citizen. Now you don't have anything that you're entitled to. You'll get what you pay for. Meanwhile, because the banking system is privately held, that's an effective pump from an unlimited amount of money from the public treasury into private hands. Just to recap that, because it is a central point for how this swindle is operated, let's hear Edward Griffin from episode 577.
One of the most incredible realizations is the fact that today every dollar that exists, either in the form of currency or checkbook money, and that includes the credit card money, the plastic money that is merely an extension of the checkbook money, all of it, in other words, our entire money supply exists only because it first was borrowed by someone. Now, it may not be you. You may be out of debt. But if you have money in your pocket, that is because it was borrowed by someone. Now, they owe the banks for this money, or you wouldn't have it. It would not be in circulation. And that means that every dollar in the whole money supply is earning daily compounded interest payable to the banking and the financial circle. Do you think you aren't working for somebody and you don't know it? The whole money supply is earning compounded interest for the financial masters of this country at one level or another. The money doesn't exist, I want to repeat this, until someone borrows it. A portion of every business venture, every investment, every profit, every transaction which involves money, and that even includes losses, even if the transaction involves a loss to someone, any transaction, a portion of that is earmarked as payment to a bank somewhere along the line. And what did the bank do to earn this interest, this payment? Did it lend this money out of its own capital? Did it take in all the savings of widows and hardworking people and lend it out at interest so that these people could have an honest return on their investments? No, it did none of these things. It simply made a bookkeeping entry, and it created the money out of nothing. Now, that's a pretty good scheme if you can get away with it. And they are getting away with it, and no one is really trying to blow the whistle because they don't understand the mandrake mechanism. And as I said earlier, it is incredible. If you try to explain it to someone, they say, oh, I don't believe that. It couldn't be. Our government wouldn't allow that to happen. That's ridiculous. It was Thomas Edison. He was among the 1 or 2% who were able to see through this legalized scam. He said, quote, people who will not turn a shovel full of dirt on the project or contribute a pound of materials will collect more money than will the people who supply all the materials and do all the work, end quote. That's it. That is feudalism. It's not an exaggeration to say that the entire nation is working to support an invisible master, and doing so without resentment or complaint because, for the most part, the people are totally unaware of that fact. They have been economically conquered in a quiet war of which they have been totally unaware.
Now, I've long been looking for good audio about the Bank for International Settlements, but it seems to be very hard to find. They're a very secretive organization, all the more shocking when you consider their influence on the world scene. Effectively, they're a private club for central bankers. One piece I did find, this is Adam Labor from episode 739.
The BIS was founded in 1930, ostensibly as a means to manage German reparations payments for the First World War, i.e. the financial penalties imposed on Germany for the First World War. But the real reason the BIS was founded was to have a place where central bankers could meet outside the supervision of politicians and away from nosy journalists. The BIS was founded by an international treaty, which means that it's similar to the United Nations or a foreign embassy. It's technically extraterritorial in Switzerland. The Swiss authorities, although it's based in Basel, the Swiss authorities need the permission of the bank's management to enter the bank, and its assets can never be seized, even during times of war. It can't really be sued under any international Swiss law, and the management enjoy a number of similar privileges to diplomats.
The Swiss authorities, if they need to have permission to actually even enter the premises, then that isn't really a part of Switzerland, Adam.
No, it's not. And I tried quite hard to find out the exact legal niceties of this, but the bank wasn't particularly helpful. But they did send me a copy of the treaty that founded the bank and the 1987 agreement with Switzerland. But as far as I could see from reading it, it means that, yes, technically, it's the same as an embassy. Well, the United Nations is legally an international body, but it's also a commercial bank, and it only has 140 customers, mostly their other central banks, and it makes its profits tax-free. It was founded in the 1930s at a time when the League of Nations was active, when there was a sort of idealism that, you know, nationalism had led the world to the horrors of the First World War, so transnationalism and supranational institutions were really the way forward.
One of the things I found fascinating looking at this bank was that for many years it was very anonymous. After the Second World War, it seems there was a certain amount of embarrassment, and that they were actually, even though they were one of the most powerful banks in the world, based with an anonymous door, and the bank was based over the top of a chocolate shop opposite Basel Station.
I mean, the bank was very anonymous before World War II. The idea, you know, this was a different age when the elites and governments and powerful people weren't really interested in being accountable. There's something of that spirit still continues. I mean, nowadays, every 2 months, the 60 big central bankers of the world meet there. People like Ben Bernanke from the Federal Reserve and Mervyn King and his successor, Mark Carney, to discuss the global economy. And someone who's been to one of those meetings gave me a great quote. He said the main topic of conversation in those meetings was the stupidity of finance ministers and the quality of the wine. So you can see that that very elitist approach continues.
Now, you said that there are 60 banks, central banks, that sort of go there and meet, but there are 120 customers. Can you give us an idea of who those customers are?
The bank doesn't say who its customers are, and this is a big contradiction. I mean, we can guess that they're mostly central banks. I think most of the central banks of the world have an account there, probably some international organisations as well. I would believe that the International Committee of the Red Cross does as well, because I found some documents in the BIS archives showing that they had dealings with the ICRC during the Second World War. But, and this is the problem, you see, because the BIS says it's an international institution with a mission of public service. Well then, who are your customers? What are you doing for customers? It's a contradiction to have the confidentiality of a commercial bank, but the privileges of an international organization. I think you're either one or the other.
It's not an exaggeration to say that the entire nation is working to support an invisible master, and doing so without resentment or complaint, because for the most part, the people are totally unaware of that fact. They have been economically conquered in a quiet war of which they have been totally unaware. Mariner Eccles was the governor of the Federal Reserve System in 1941. And on June 24 of that year, Eccles was asked to give testimony before the House Committee on Banking and Currency. Now, he didn't like to do that. And reading through that testimony is interesting, because you think politicians can sidestep answers and be like a greased eel. You should read the testimony of governors of the Federal Reserve Board. They're masters. But in this one segment, he was pretty straightforward. The purpose of the hearing was to obtain information regarding the role of the Federal Reserve in creating the conditions that led to the Depression of the 1930s. Congressman Wright Patman, who was chairman of that committee, asked the question, how did you get the money to buy those $2 billion worth of government securities in 1933? Eccles answered, we created it. Patman, out of what? Answer, out of the right to issue credit money. Question, and there is nothing behind it, is there, except our government's credit? Answer, that's what our money system is. If there were no debts in our money system, there wouldn't be any money. End quote.
Now, you might find it an illustrative experience to try and explain that phenomenon to someone else. My thought is, although on one level it's not a very difficult point to grasp, fairly rudimentary, really, I have never seen that in any economics textbook. So my suspicion is that the more financial training somebody's had and the more they work with money on a day-to-day basis, then the harder it will be for somebody to take that simple point on board. And this is an illustration how our higher education system, so-called, can disconnect us from basic truths. It's a point that I made to the Chaos Computer Congress in Berlin, broadcast in episode 585.
Economic literacy says that you are economically literate if you know that people should be self-interested, and if you're not self-interested, then you're kind of irrational. So it's basically brainwashing you to think in a certain way, that specific way, that means that you do a cost-benefit analysis on everything. Now, that sounds, again, like common sense in a certain perspective, but if there's a group of people who have an unlimited amount of money because they control the money system, they're in a good position to manipulate the cost-benefit analysis.
5:30.
At the moment,
it appears as though much of what happens in schools in North America is really for the convenience of people who have most of the power. There is, if anything, an act of discouragement of critical questioning. Corporations claim they want kids who are able to think outside the box, but only so far as they're caught within a larger box that works to the advantage of the free market, which means that the market economy, based on competition, based on economic rather than human considerations, ends up controlling the system.
Derek Jensen from 311.
Robert J. Lifton wrote this great, great book called The Nazi Doctors, and he asked the fundamental question, how could people who had taken the Hippocratic Oath work in death camps? What he found was that many of them actually did everything they could to make things better for the Jews and other inmates in the camps. Everything within their power, except question the larger concentration camp. So they would give someone who was in pain, they would give them an aspirin to lick. They would hide them from people making selections. They would, selections for murder. They would do all these things. They would do everything except question the concentration camp. What we do so often is we do everything we can to save this or that piece of ground, except question the larger picture.
Here's another angle on economics. If you learned economics, maybe you thought, okay, if you want to borrow money as an individual, then you get some money from the banks, do some business, pay it back with interest, because of course banks need interest, huh? They've got to make a profit. So that is the micro level. I'm encouraging you to look at it on the macro level. We, humanity, borrow money from banks, certain amount, we have to give it back with interest. Where does the interest come from? We are not allowed to make our own money. You know, there's all these laws about forgery and so on. And, oh, well, then I guess it's got to come from the banks, hasn't it? So we get it from the banks next year if they're feeling like they're kind to us. Thanks, boss. So basically, you're getting more and more in debt. The economics, the microeconomics says, if you're a good businessman, you can make some profit. Okay, great. I don't care who's good at business and who's not. It's not possible for everybody to pay back those loans to the bank. And the bank can control this. They have a little dial called the interest rate. And if they increase the interest rate, if they don't give new loans, more and more people will go under. So it's a divide and conquer mechanism against the people. Now, I'm claiming that this is tribute. This is the equivalent of in the Viking days, the Vikings would come to your village and say, I want some gold, otherwise we're going to come back and we'll destroy your village. That was quite effective at getting gold. But it was also effective at annoying people. They didn't like it. Well, this is what we have now in the money system. But if you're economically literate, you know that that's the way that it's supposed to be, because you've been trained to see it from a certain perspective.
586.
While most of us struggle to stay ahead, billions of dollars in profits flow into the hands of private bankers at our expense. For this is how the system works. Whenever the government needs money, it requests it from the Federal Reserve. But the Fed doesn't just give the money to the government, it loans the money at interest. Every dollar the government loans from the Federal Reserve Bank has to be paid back with interest. This keeps the government, and as such the people, in a continual state of debt. All of our income taxes are paid back to the Federal Reserve to pay off the debt that the government incurs when it borrows money from the Federal Reserve Bank.
319.
And finally, with the emergence of the market economy, where all corporate ties are dissolved, where the guild ties are dissolved, and the clan ties are dissolved, and even the ties created by the extended family are dissolved.
Now, to chip in from my Bangladesh experience, having lived here for a couple of decades, one of the things which is perhaps remarkable from a Western perspective is that it goes without saying that family commitments, if you've got a wedding or a funeral or some other pressing family call upon your time, that will take priority over an employer's expectations. So quite annoying if you're a business manager and trying to keep your staff under control, but from a human perspective, I think an entirely natural thing. If it seems unnatural that you struggle to get time off work in order to attend a family commitment, that is something which has become normal. It's been normalized by this process that Bookchin is referring to, the dissolution of family ties as a process of making individuals single, free-flowing units who are therefore that much easier to marshal around to a corporate agenda.
All into free-moving atoms who are buyers and sellers in a jungle called free enterprise, one emerges with another image of the natural world. The natural world, too, is a jungle of buyers and sellers, prey and predators. And the Darwinian description of it, particularly those who follow Darwin, Huxley and others, with their emphasis on the survival of the fittest, with their emphasis on prey and predator, with their emphasis on natural selection, with their view of nature as a jungle, eat or be eaten, reflected exactly the relationships that existed in the 19th century marketplace between capitalists and between the capitalist class and the working class.
For more of a fundamental rethink, let's turn now to Ivan Illich. He's not particularly widely known, but I would encourage you, if you're not already quite familiar with Illich, to review what he had to say. I found it to be extremely helpful at getting at the roots of the modern malaise. This is new material to the show. This is from a CBC podcast entitled Part Moon, Part Travelling Salesman.
For Illich, these early writings were only starting points. As his thinking evolved, he became less interested in these institutions as such, and more interested in the state of mind which made them possible. And what he noticed above all about this modern state of mind is how completely it is penetrated by the assumptions of economics, that resources are scarce and society a domain of endlessly competing values. He began to oppose a sphere of traditional subsistence in which culture still shapes and limits economic life, to a sphere of scarcity in which economic values predominate. He redefined development as the war against subsistence, and education as learning under the assumption of scarcity.
We continue with a reading from Charles Eisenstein's Ascent of Humanity, and if you'd like to download the whole audiobook, that is available from this show's webpage. You can go to unwelcomeguest.net/audiobooks and download any of the books that we have produced. One of Eisenstein's central themes in the book is the separation, how the modern ideas, the modern society is structured to separate us from each other, from our finer selves, and certainly from the natural world. And he's making the point that this has deleterious and unhealthy consequences. This is from episode 469. He's talking about the effects on different societies when their unique values and customs and practices are replaced by market regulation mechanisms.
For most of human history, no one imagined you could own a story. Stories were simply not conceivable objects of property, but constituted in each culture a vast commonwealth. Today, corporations such as Disney mine that commonwealth, wall off parts of it for themselves, and convert it into money. A related erosion of cultural capital is the hollowing out and commoditization of our holiday customs and religious traditions. Starting with Christmas, one by one, our holidays have been reduced to the buying of things. Each is a fountain of profit. For Valentine's Day, we buy chocolate and flowers. For Easter, we buy candy. For 4th of July, we buy firecrackers. For Halloween, we buy costumes. Last year, my children were the only ones I saw with homemade costumes. For Christmas, in addition to gifts of all descriptions, we buy wreaths, decorations, and cookies. And for all holidays, we buy greeting cards. A new trend in the restaurant business is Thanksgiving dinner with all the trappings. Why cook it at home when it is so much more efficient to have restaurant chefs do it? Remember again the quintessential business idea. Find something that people still do for themselves and sell it to them instead.
So Eisenstein's brief summary of business there helps me to understand why, in spite of some training in business studies, that instinctively never really appealed to me. In theory, you're offering people new goods and services, so potentially you're improving their lives. In practice, the real focus is on profit extraction. And if you're profiting at people's expense, then, well, you're still profiting under the business rules as they currently apply. In practice, it's not often as crude as the Bechtel water situation, where you tell people, no, you're not allowed to drink water from the sky, you have to get it from us. It's usually a few layers more subtle than that, but the close connection between the business and the government means, very commonly, it is what Illich refers to as a war on subsistence. So you have people trying to subsist and do their own thing, and if the government rules, then there's eminent domain. Well, tough luck, we just took your land. Or if they say, well, fracking is fracking and we like fracking, it makes money, then we just took your groundwater and filled it with poisons. So that's why I never really got attracted to business, and was initially, before I'd actually had much experience of how charities operate, of course they are money-focused organizations, and similar problems apply. For a summary of how NGOs work in the capitalist system, let's hear from episode 710.
There's a great analogy that's been drawn to understand specifically NGOs in today's context. Take a look at the missionary societies of the age of formal empires, so the great European empires. You know, the missionary societies were very much a part of the imperial project. They essentially created consent among those the empires wished to dominate. They spread new ideas, dismissed their old ideas, religions, beliefs, and allowed for the empires to come in and control these people and control their land. And so NGOs essentially act as modern missionaries in the globalized world, because what they do is that even with people with the best of intentions who join these societies, and many of the missionaries themselves had the best of intentions, though the people at the top knew exactly what they were really intended for, just like the NGOs, they're filled with people with great intentions, but they ultimately go around the world treating symptoms, which essentially, you know, you provide some education, you provide health services, some food, etc. Very symptom relevant. But you do not try to change the structure, the root causes of, you know, you're not questioning why is there a lack of education? Why is there excessive poverty? Why is there no food? Why is there no health care? You're not seeking to change, to ask those questions and change the results. You're just treating them. And that makes the system more secure because it pacifies people against active resistance. So it's like this giant siphon for good intentions that actually just establishes more consent to the very system that it's seeking to change.
Well, and the philanthropists know that their fortunes are a magnet for people who want to do good but don't have their own means to address those problems. And so it does become a kind of perfect form of co-optation.
Now, I thought I would leave that comment in there because you may have not noticed anything, and that's an illustration of just how invisible the money system has managed to make itself. You have people who want to do good but don't have the means to do good. well, is money a means to do good? The point that I'm making is that we seem to think the same way that if you want to climb a building, you just get a ladder. If you want to mobilize people, if you want help to do something, then you use money. So if you have no money, you're not going to get any help. But that is some kind of a paradox, which I would like to unpack here. So if you want to do good and help other people, isn't it realistic to think, yeah, they're going to want to help me help them? Or other people are going to want to help me help them, because other people want to do good. So if other people want to help me do that, then what's the need for money? And people did used to work together, some of them still do, without using money. We are all conditioned that money is real value, whereas in fact we know in our heart of hearts that it's not. Money is not an absolute good, it's a relative good. Money works because there are poor people who feel that they need it. People, if they can't meet their physical survival needs without using money, well, the war on subsistence has succeeded and brought them into the fold. It's not possible for everybody to be financially wealthy. It's like if you had an exam for school and everybody passed the exam. Well, then there's no point putting that on your CV, because you're trying to distinguish yourself and put yourself above other people. So money is inherently about a hierarchy, and that allows some things to be done. One thing that it does not address is to remove the problems that arise from a hierarchy. If you say, well, we need money in order to do anything, those problems become invisible. So this is an avenue I explore in episode 551, entitled Understanding the Financial Crisis. When I listen to this, I think, well, my opinions haven't really moved on much in the last 8 years, which you can think, well, okay, I was ahead of my time, or you can think, well, I'm just stuck in a rut. I'll leave the interpretation up to you. But this is what I had to say about thinking outside of the box, exactly that box which economic literacy in particular, but school in general, tries to make sure that everybody will spend their life trapped in. Why then do so many people believe they do need money? Well, it fits with their life experience. Many of them have grown up thinking, yes, of course I need food, of course I need a house, how am I going to get that? Ah, money. So they confuse a strategy for meeting their needs, buying them, and what they need to fulfill that strategy, money, with the goods themselves. And this may seem like a small point, as I think it's going to be increasingly important to detach from fictional needs, such as money, and to focus only on meeting real needs. Why is this so hard for people? Well, there's a big psychology of previous investment. When you've been committed to something for a long time, it takes a lot of psychological effort and upheaval to admit, no, that was a dead end, I'm not going to go there anymore, I'm going to give up on that. People don't want to do that. And that, I think, explains some of the reason why people are so committed to the modern money system, in spite of the fact that an objective evaluation would say, well, continuing this is not in these people's interests. Well, perhaps it's a human tendency to try and abbreviate the complex set of needs by saying, well, all I need is money. But we shouldn't underestimate the concerted apparatus of those who control the money system. And that is their privilege. If I start telling people what to do and how to do it, they're likely to remain uninterested. If I get a wallet full of banknotes out and wave them at people, then yes, I have slaves everywhere, people who are willing to do just what I say, just how I like it, sir, as long as they get my money. And so the financially wealthy are elite and powerful only to the extent that people need this money that they're handing out. And of course, that's why the money system in its modern form doesn't give money, it lends it out, and creating a perpetual shortage of wealth. Now, those super wealthy who are in that position are able to control, as we've looked at several times on the show, media systems, so commercial entertainment, governments largely, large organizations, and the net effect of all their policies is to reinforce people's delusion that money is what they need. What's called economic development has made many people reliant on the money system for their survival. A community of people without money, in which some farm, some teach, some do other things, but they exchange their fruits of their labor without using money, is not a system that money has any power over. Nobody in that system needs money to survive. This is erstwhile economic hitman John Perkins from episode 526, Understanding Economic Development.
Those people, many of them lived on subsistence economies. True, they may never have made any money before, but they lived very well on subsistence economies until these companies came in and created a local market, a local economy that now depends on the dollar. So in a very few years, they've gone from living subsistence lives and statistically having no money at all, totally impoverished statistically, but their lives are quite good, to now suddenly having to work for these big corporations, working in these sweatshops, making a dollar a day, dependent on the dollar economy, or maybe it's $10 a day, whatever, but dependent on money, and the subsistence existence they had before is gone. And then that company, the next year, decides that the labor pool is cheaper someplace else, and they move out. And these people who become dependent on these pittances they've been paid by our companies suddenly don't have even the pittance.
Perhaps not coincidentally, those type of communities where they're non-monified are defined by the IMF as the poorest of all and the most in need of attention. So if you can persuade somebody in that community, you're poor. Your life would be better if you were rich. You should be selling your output rather than giving it away or bartering it. And once you sell it, then people need money to buy it. If you're a farmer, you won't be giving them rice if they haven't got money, if that's what selling means. So those people then need to start charging money for whatever it is that they're doing. And the toxic need for money infects the whole community. And so the whole process of lifting communities out of poverty can be understood as replacing the existing social bonds and cultural understandings by the culture of money. And what does the culture of money say? It says, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And if you can't pay, you shouldn't eat. That is the process that has been ongoing through a lot of my lifetime, all around the world.
For a look at how money works on the individual, let's hear from episode 599, this is from 2012. I'm going over a presentation I wrote entitled What Economics Can't Tell You About Money.
Before people put their hands in hot water, they did some chatting about two different topics. One was a neutral topic, i.e. the weather. One was losing money. And the people who talked about losing money rated the hot water as significantly more painful than if they'd been talking about the weather. And again, for the socially excluded, the difference is much larger. So those people who have been socially excluded are rating the pain as almost twice as high if they'd been talking about money loss compared to if they'd been talking about the weather. So if you think pain is a physical thing that depends on the temperature of the water and people's sensitivity on their hands, well, it clearly isn't just that, because it's related to what's on their mind, what they've been talking about. And talking about losing money is literally a painful topic, and especially so when people are already feeling social exclusion. So why is this? Well, a quote from the research, quote, "The mere idea of money has considerable psychological power, enough to alter reactions to social exclusion and even to physical pain," unquote. So money is working as a kind of social painkiller. How come just touching money reduces people's pain? Well, thinking about money makes most people feel strong and independent. They're not dependent on other people because they've got plenty of money. So if they need help, they can buy it.
So money effectively reduces people's natural desire for friendship, because they don't rely on their friends, they rely on their money. Does this help us understand the typical image of a miser who's counting his money? Maybe he hasn't got friends, but he's feeling secure, he's feeling comfort from his money. Does this help us understand how the super rich feel like keeping their debt on the books, keeping their paper money total increasing, is more important than maintaining social relationships or even maintaining a healthy ecosystem?
735.
If you want people to perform better, you reward them, right? Bonuses, commissions, their own reality show, incentivize them. That's how business works. But that's not happening here. You've got an incentive designed to sharpen thinking and accelerate creativity, and it does just the opposite. It dulls thinking and blocks creativity. And what's interesting about this experiment is that it's not an aberration. This has been replicated over and over and over again for nearly 40 years. These contingent motivators. If you do this, then you get that. Work in some circumstances, but for a lot of tasks, they actually either don't work or often they do harm. This is one of the most robust findings in social science, and also one of the most ignored. If you look at the science, there is a mismatch between what science knows and what business does.
So just to underscore that point, economics, apart from being based on lies, claims this is why we do the things we do. It's about motivating people, they'll perform better. When subjected to critical inquiry, this turns out not to be the case. These contingent motivators generally don't work to make people more effective at what they do. It suggests to me that perhaps that story about why it does what it does is actually just not true. Let's hear Alfie Cohn from episode 530.
The research consistently shows that competition not only isn't necessary for excellence, but tends to impede excellence on most tasks. And the more challenging the task, the more ingenuity, problem-solving skill it requires, the more competition tends to disrupt that achievement. Excellence pulls in one direction and competition pulls in another. And in fact, another kind of research study corroborates that. If you take a whole bunch of people and give them a task to do, some kind of problem to work out, and half of them are told, see if you can figure out how to do this task. And the other half are told this is a contest with a prize to whoever wins, whoever does the best job. Study after study after study across cultures, across gender, across ages, find that the people who compete, who have to compete, end up doing an inferior job on that task.
So, to recap there, we have an economic system which, as Murray Bookchin has pointed out, shapes our attitudes and behavior to the natural world, an economic system which highlights the importance of competition, conflict, getting ahead, zero-sum games, being number one, which is nominally predicated on the claim that this is going to somehow make people perform better. We have a lot of evidence that actually this does exactly the opposite. So I suggest an alternative explanation. Well, not me, in fact, but John Taylor Gatto. Recall what he earlier said about schools.
Under corporate capitalism and corporate governance, ways must be found to make the general public less productive and less self-reliant. And school is the mechanism to do that.
Gatto says school is the mechanism to do that. I'm going to say more precisely, school is a part of the mechanism to make people less self-reliant and less productive. This resolves at a stroke the apparent paradox why, if we have a lot of evidence that the current system of financial incentives actually degrades performance, why the massive drive to apply it universally to the extent that people find it very difficult to imagine any other way of doing things.
it now becomes apparent from this perspective that the money system, just like school, which is after all a preparation for the money system, in schools you focus the children not on what they're learning or what they've created, but instead on the marks, on these numbers given to them by authority figures, which the system has placed outside of any personal context in command of them. That's more or less how the modern school system works, and I think it's not a stretch to see that as a close mirror, and therefore a preparation for the economic situation, and how many parents, after all, send their children to so-called good schools in order that they can get a so-called good job, where the focus is never on the intrinsic value of the work being done in real terms, but on the salary, on the imaginary tokens given out by the authority figure known as the boss. As Bookchin points out, this worldview, which is implicit in the economic system, it then provides a backdrop to look at nature and to see individual species competing with one another, the survival of the fittest. This has been a great replacement for the powers that be, for the Christian message. Some of the things that Jesus had to say about giving your extra shirt to the person who had no shirts, not an easy fit with laissez-faire capitalism, but they, of course, gave up Christianity, focused instead on Darwinism. Darwin didn't actually say that nature is red in tooth and claw and it's all about getting one over on the next species. These are misinterpretations which are attributed to the Darwinian viewpoint. I think Spencer was the man to look at who really came up with this phrase, survival of the fittest. But to return to the topic of the money system, the suggestion that it may not be a big mistake by the powers that be, as much as a cleverly disguised lie, which seems to justify a ruthless treatment of one another, the elite's ruthless domination of those whom they would order about. Let's, for another angle on how this system operates to subvert the political and social process, hear from Charles Eisenstein, author of The Center for Humanity, and this is new material to the show. It's episode 3 from his podcast, A New and Ancient Story.
A lot of the pursuit of monetary wealth and a lot of the insecurity around that kind of reflects a deep insecurity and sense of not belonging in the world and not being nourished by the world, not being having intimate connections with nature, with community. You know, you miss all that and then you're hungry for something. Mm. And wealth kind of fills that void. But as we're seeing with the whole financial merry-go-round now, how much, you know, like sometimes I'll read Zero Hedge or one of the insider financial websites, and people are so paranoid and I guess anxious is the word for it. And these are the people with money. Most of them are in the top 1% or close to it. Mm-hmm. And it's just so obvious that it almost seems like wealth is causing them anxiety.
Well, it is. And it should be, because for a lot of these people, they've wrapped their identity up in it. And so that's their narrative. They're running around with this narrative that identifies themselves with their wealth. And they know on some level that this is fantasy wealth, because all you have to do is read any one of 100 books now on the subject that says money's printed out of thin air, which means it's an idea that one segment of society, and a very small one, gets to just literally make out of thin air.
Yeah.
So it's like your whole identity depends on what the magician is going to do next, you know, and you know deep down you can't control that.
Now let's hear Derek Jensen from episode 700.
We will protect what we value, and we will protect what we love. And right now, what people love most and what people value most are these authoritarian techniques. You know, they value the economy over the real world, and they value so-called human ingenuity over the real world, and they value television over the real world. And they value pretty much everything over the real world. And what they really value is their sense of superiority that is created by all those things.
Now, I find that an interesting emphasis, that Derek Jensen emphasizes the sense of superiority. Why is that so important? More important, for example, than having a healthy planet on which to live? Is it perhaps because, given the competitive view of nature that stems from our economic system, the choices are simple, eat or be eaten. So a way to handle insecurity is to cause insecurity to others. Of course, I'm working my way round to an alternative view of nature, one which sees us in dynamic equilibrium, in harmony. Yes, competition on occasions, but a lot of the time, cooperation. We couldn't live without the other species. To try and put ourselves ahead of these species, in some metaphysical sense, is to misunderstand what it is to be a human. For some more insights into how money affects individual human beings, let's hear from episode 617.
What the researchers concluded was that while money was great at motivating individual effort, it carried with it negative social side effects. In the conflict that we all experience between interest in ourselves and our concern for others, money appears to motivate only interest in ourselves. It makes us feel self-sufficient. We don't need others. It's each man for himself. Let's take this out of the lab and into the real world. On one level, we know this is true. As long as I have money, I don't need other people. If I can pay a nanny, I don't have to ask my friends or my family to help me with childcare. We can all afford to drive our own cars, our own kids, to school in our own cars, as long as we can afford them. If I have a very great deal of money, I don't have to interact with people at all. You can take the example of Richard Fuld, chief executive of Lehman Brothers, whose daily commute from Greenwich, Connecticut, saw him successively in a limousine alone, in a private plane alone, in another limousine alone, until he drew up before a private lift that stood waiting with its doors open to take him up to his office, so that at no point in this journey did he ever have to speak to a single human being. Money changes how we think. And it changes the choices that we make.
So that is a very simple point, and most people seem to be unaware of the subliminal influence that even tiny reminders of money can have upon them. For more implications of what that means, as far as the political process goes, this is Derek Jensen from episode 491.
So like 50% of the people in the House of Representatives, etc., are millionaires, and they are defending what is real to them. What is real to them is Wall Street. It's not even the economy, but it's Wall Street. There's a great line by this Brazilian general in the 1960s. Somebody asked him how the economy of Brazil is doing. He said, the economy is doing well, the people not so well.
So, a small number of legislators and politicians who are charged with the decision-making as far as society goes, and as selfish individuals, they are encouraged to pay attention to the economy as opposed to the welfare of the people of the country, their constituents whom they're supposedly representing. And if they're not paying attention to their fellow Americans, how much less attention are they paying to the citizens of the rest of the world? Recall the words of George Kennan.
We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. Our real task is to devise a pattern of relationship which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity.
Now, we've heard how the CIA was using warlords, assassinations, coups, and so forth, to try to perpetuate what George Kennan called that pattern of relationships. Let's hear from one of those involved in the wizardry angle, somebody who was intimately involved in ensnaring the so-called economically underdeveloped countries of the world in perpetual debt.
John Perkins, speaking on episode 526.
5% of the world's population, us, the American population, consumes 25% of the world's resources. Now that really bothers most of the rest of the world, that we're like this great octopus that reaches out with its tentacles and brings all the resources into us, and look at the lives we lead, while 3/4 of the world lives in destitution. Every day, 24,000 people die of starvation, and 30,000 children die of curable diseases every single day. And the people who live in the places where that's happening are angry. And they see us, 5% of the world's population, bringing in 25% of its resources, while so many of them live tragic, destitute, miserable, suffering lives, needlessly suffering. It doesn't have to happen. An even more important statistic, I believe, is that of that 5% of the world's population, only less than 1% controls more of America's resources than the 90% at the bottom. So in fact, 25% of the world's resources are being funneled into this country essentially to serve 1% of 5% of the world's population. Terribly small. It's not even a pyramid. It's like a needle going up with a few very wealthy, very powerful people sitting on the top. It's created tremendous resentment around the world. It's what's created our insecurity. I would suggest that we will never be secure in this country, no matter how many guards we have at our airports, until we decide that we're going to be a lot more compassionate with the world. And what a great thing that is to do. That will bring us the security that we need, is when we start really opening ourselves up to the world and welcoming the world as brothers and sisters.
John Perkins, an example of a man trained as an economist to be an economic hitman, to work on a level of targets, performance indicators, numerical, left side of the brain, somehow opened himself up, contacted the local people, and through personal contact started to see what he was doing in a new light, to look at the consequences for individual human beings on the ground, and reached a very different conclusion about what he wanted to do with his life. From the perspective of fear, if the US is really afraid about bombs going off, then more metal detectors make some sense. As he points out, the backdrop, which is rarely, if ever, questioned on corporate media, is a tremendously selfish appropriation of the world's resources. We're still, if you like, suffering the legacy of the selfishness which George Kennan was testimony to and a part of, trying to construct a pattern of relationships that gave the US disproportionately, not only as a country from other countries, but within the US, disproportionately skewed resources to a tiny elite who became obsessed with security, obsessed with the material benefits, and as a result, however much they acquired, it was not enough. I think that still has to play itself out. John Perkins highlighting, if we can overcome the fear, then an apparently contradictory policy of taking down the walls, not investing in weapons, instead focusing on feeding, clothing, sheltering the poor and needy of the world. There is a lot of good work that could be done in this world. Not a lot of it, as I see it, is very financially rewarding. So, to highlight an even more fundamental contradiction about the world in which we live, and to shine a light on possibly some unexamined concepts, let me ask you the question, do you think that we should pay our debts? That's an introduction to David Graeber, who wrote Debt, the First 5,000 Years, our most popular audiobook to date. You can download that at unwelcomeguest.net/audiobooks. Here he is being interviewed by Sasha Lilly from Against the Grain, which we broadcast in episode 664.
David, why is the notion that people must pay the financial debts they accrue so deeply ingrained in our society?
It's a really interesting question, and one of the reasons I wrote the book was because it somewhat mystified me. One of the things that really impressed me was the degree to which the argument, you know, people have to pay their debts, could be used to justify things that just could never have been justified in any other way. Particularly when I was involved in the global justice movement, we were doing campaigns about third world debt, and we could tell stories about poor people whose lives were completely destroyed, dying babies, and the things that people would otherwise consider an atrocity. And even very liberal-minded people would say, well, that's terrible, but, I mean, surely you're not saying people aren't going to pay their debts. I mean, they borrowed the money. So that was really the problem I was trying to solve. And what I ended up concluding is that there's been a very, very long and deep process that has gone on for thousands of years whereby our basic notions of morality and what it is to have a moral obligation, what it is to make a promise, have been kind of caught up in this financial logic, have been so corrupted by it that we can't tell the two apart.
As a supreme example of that confusion, if you're a German speaker, the word Schuld simultaneously means guilt and debt. So I can imagine that proved quite handy to controllers of the German money system over the years, because if you equate those two ideas, their ability to create money out of thin air because they can use that money to absolve debts now can erase sins, if there's an equivalence between the two. So they're not only the masters of the economic universe but also the moral universe. And this, I think, gives us some insight into how this millennia-long confusion has happened. The people who de facto control the wheels of commerce because they get to decide what's money and what's not money, these people are interested to promote themselves not only the arbiters of economic matters but as the arbiters of virtue. And because money greases palms, this has been allowed to happen. In a postmodern society, we're not having lots of laws on the books about different religious policies, traditional customs. People are, in that sense, free. The one area, however, which is very tightly circumscribed, which provides a kind of an anchor, an answer to what is expected behaviour, is that it is expected that you will earn money. The neoliberal axiom, Homo economicus, assumes there is nobody out there who cares about anybody else, so you are going to have to provide for yourself, and it's a war on subsistence. You're going to have to do it through money. In theory, tribal people may be free to be left alone to do their own thing, but in practice, they're not contributing to the system. So the system has an economic interest to bring them within its fold, at which point then they'll have to start to open up their land to development, and so on and so forth. So this model, Homo economicus, is used, in spite of the fact that we know it's a gross oversimplification, not just inaccurate, but one that specifically increases selfishness, promotes competition. That's used, and deleterious social consequences have followed around the world. Some societies have understood this more than others. People from all sorts of different social, historical, cultural, religious backgrounds are finding that their societies are being restructured along the lines of all against all, a kind of neoliberal Darwinian replacement, because morality itself has been replaced by economics, and economics with a tiny elite who head a central bank which has the ability to create money out of nothing. So whilst the names of the currencies and central banks are different and goes to great lengths to try to avoid public discussion about what's going on, try to hide behind control of the media, it's actually a very simple global plan that's been rolled out. People are being ripped off in very similar ways around the world. It's a one-stop shop. Privatize everything, hand over control to a tiny elite who have control of the public discourse, as well as the natural resources. One of the problems, the roadblock that is hitting, is the absolute material deprivation, the scarcity which the economic model assumes, is itself manifesting. Another roadblock it's hitting is people are increasingly seeing through the lies. They did work quite well. I think for my generation, many people of my age still believe the world is going to get better and better the more capitalism we can roll out. I'm talking particularly about people in the West. The communication between all parts of the globe, which the Internet and the World Wide Web have facilitated, has certainly played a big role to facilitating this global discussion. Is this the sort of world that we would like to live in? I think David Graeber has played a great part in highlighting the role of debt as a tool that is used to encourage people to see the world through rectangular spectacles, if you like. That is, to see it through the left brain as not a living entity with which empathy, shared feelings are important, but as a set of lifeless objects which can be put at our disposal according to our own selfish interests.
I guess really the question that needs to be asked first is, what is wrong with the notion that, because it's kind of a common sense notion, that if you take out a debt, you should pay it. Why not?
Well, I mean, on one level, it makes obvious common sense because a debt is just a promise. Now, if I make a promise to someone, I mean, it is a solemn commitment, and if people paid no attention to their promises, well, the world would be a very horrible place. On the other hand, a debt is a very particular type of promise, and the problem is that we've come to imagine all promises as if they were debts. But a debt is not just a promise. A debt is a promise that has become turned into mathematics, and once it has been turned into mathematics, you can precisely quantify what someone owes.
So, the convenience of that system is clear. This is something we can now mediate entirely through mathematics. But that is only possible because we are disregarding bigger picture thoughts about right and wrong. Have we got so little confidence in human abilities to discern meaning and context and to make judgment calls on personal matters such as relationships? I believe if we see the world as craving for a larger mathematical system to run everything, this, as Murray Bookchin would say, is a reflection or an echo of the technologies of our time. We've made these things called computers, so we can look at the natural world and say, well, this is all just one big computer. So if we can structure things according to an impersonal fashion, then that's the natural way to do it. Let's hear what Murray Bookchin had to say about the modern era, the era of super quantification.
Now we're moving into a new era. And this is the era of corporate capitalism, of state capitalism, of super planning and super quantification. A quantification which already began to emerge with Galileo and with the rising bourgeoisie, with its concern for accumulation, with its concern for prices, with its laws of supply and demand. And we're creating a new quantified constellation that we call nature. This is a nature again that lends itself to quantification on the assumption that quantification is truth.
Once it has been turned into mathematics, you can precisely quantify what someone owes. It becomes impersonal. It becomes detached from the quality of the relationship of the people who have made promises to one another. And as a result of that, it becomes detachable so that, like, if I make a promise to you, you can't turn that promise over to a third party. With a debt, because it's impersonal, you can. So it's when you get morality caught up in that, that kind of mathematical logic, that terrible things can start to happen, particularly when you add interest to that. And what I discovered is that it's not a natural transformation. It's not like there's something about the nature of promises that makes us want to turn them into math. Quite the opposite. That forcing promises into that kind of mold where it seems that, you know, debts and obligations and promises are all just kind of the same thing really only happens through the medium of violence. Historically, it's
always been in context of either potential violence or violence, that leap can be made.
I think that's a key point that David Graeber makes, which will help us to understand the explosion of violence in the modern world. How did impersonal human relationships, mediated by lots of different factors, certainly not primarily focused on mathematics, how did that get replaced by corporate contracts which dished out according to laws which were interpreted by governments, which says, well, we are the government and we have a right to enforce what we say. So we have a legal monopoly on violence popping up just at the same time as laws start to become the sine qua non of modern life and personal relationships recede into the distance. So let's hear from David Graeber. This is as background to the $1 trillion bailouts that we're going to get onto. How did that originally pop up? This is reading from the book in episode 629.
The difference between owing someone a favour and owing someone a debt is that the amount of a debt can be precisely calculated. Calculation demands equivalence. And such equivalence, especially when it involves equivalence between human beings, and it always seems to start that way, because at first human beings are always the ultimate values, only seems to occur when people have been forcibly severed from their contexts, so much so that they can be treated as identical to something else, as in 7 marten skins and 12 large silver rings for the return of your captured brother, 1 of your 3 daughters as surety for this loan of 150 bushels of grain. This, in turn, leads to that great embarrassing fact that haunts all human attempts to return to the market as the highest form of human freedom, that, historically, impersonal commercial markets originate in theft.
The most striking example in all of this is the whole population issue. And I couldn't think of perhaps a more dramatic example of how we have taken our social views and projected them upon the natural world and then permitted them to bounce off to reinforce these social views again. We have a population problem only in a certain sense to begin with. And German fascism and fascism generally saw this. As machinery began to replace labor, as labor itself became increasingly superfluous with the advance of technology in the 19th century and then going into the 20th century, the problem of how to deal with masses of unemployed who were restless, how to occupy them, how to keep them from becoming a threat to the social system, became one of the most pronounced features of fascism. One does not have to go to Ehrlich and one does not have to go to Garrett Hardin. Quite accurately, the previous speaker has gone back to Hitler himself, but not so much to Hitler, but to a problem that Hitler faced. From the standpoint of German fascism in the 1930s, even though population was declining, even though France was giving bonuses at that time for larger families, Europe was excessively populated. It was excessively populated with respect to the technology that one saw around. It was excessively populated when one had 14, 15, and 16% unemployed. Even though at that time, the birth rate was going down. And out of this, German fascism built a whole demographic system based upon racism, which involved the readjustment of population to the realities of the industrial system of the 1930s and, sinisterly enough, to realities which exist to this day. The supposition and the ideological base for all of these concepts which finally led to Auschwitz, which finally led to Bergen-Belsen, which finally led to the gas chambers of Europe, in which millions of people were destroyed, not only on the basis of ethnic reasons, but on the basis of overpopulation. The rationale for that was an image of nature and an image of the natural world and population dynamics in the natural world that was imputed to the social world because of social needs, not because of natural facts.
I feel strongly that the concept of overpopulation is a specious one. It's a use of language to misdirect and hide from the reality. I wrote an essay on this in 2010 entitled Overpopulation, Too Many People or Too Many Selfish People. I shall link in the whole essay, it's one page, but let me just summarise it by reading what I've wrote in bold as headlines. I regularly listen to speakers for whose opinions I have a lot of respect, but whose warnings about overpopulation strike me as unworthy of them. Are they unknowingly echoing the existential angst inherent in the survival of the fittest worldview? The idea of overpopulation has a striking simplicity. Talk of too many people emphasizes people's numbers, as if numbers alone were the problem. Although harder to predict and not subject to quantitative analysis, the issue of how people live in the world is of more importance than how many. I'm very interested in predictions of the natural world, but not in quantitative predictions on a human level. Crises so manifold and powerful are ongoing that soon even the richest and most deluded will no longer be able to think they can buy their way out. Bereft of significant relationships with the world around them, many Westerners feel devoid of uniqueness, intimacy, and meaning as never before. The main thrust of my argument is this, that as a human being, I do not feel that I am necessarily consuming the world. Yes, I do need food and a place to live. There's requirements which I can manage and create, and I can give back to the world. If we look upon humans as inherently damaging to the planet, well, then the ideal number is none at all. If, on the other hand, we use our gifts and our technology, not as Homo economicus would direct us, for selfish maximization, with all the violence and destruction that that entails, but as my heart pulls me towards altruistic co-creation, towards living a life full of meaning together with the rest of the planet, all the organisms, then I think we could heal a lot of the damage that we have done to this planet within a generation. We could, to pick one example, plant so many trees that we have not only a cooler planet and a nicer planet to be on, one that pumps oxygen back into the atmosphere, one that builds soil, and one that gives out a universal basic income of fruit and nuts to anybody who wants to pick them. Overpopulation focuses on reducing the numbers, and I live in the most densely populated country of the world, in which still manages to provide me with a very satisfying life, and people as a whole seem to be much happier here than in Western countries, where they have a much larger ecological footprint. So which is harder, to build ourselves two more planet Earths, or to start to behave as if we were going to live here for the duration? Start to treat this planet with the respect, the love, the care that it's given to each one of us. So I'm interested in why do people whose opinions I often have so much respect for, as a rule, tend to really depart from common sense in terms of overpopulation? Is it perhaps because they live in the West and people's self-image is so corrupted there. What could be doing that corrupting? Well, let's hear from episode 599.
What the worker sells is his life. He may sell it piecemeal. He may only sell 40 or 50 hours of it per week. But nevertheless, that is what he is selling. A mistake that some people make when they think about the labour theory of value is to think that the worker is selling his labour, right? That he's selling the tasks that he is performing, that this is the commodity that's exchanged. Well, that isn't actually the case in a system of wage labour. In a system of wage labour, what the worker sells is his time, right? He gets paid the same no matter what he does at work, as long as he remains there for a particular amount of time. Well, our time is indistinguishable from our lives. So when we sell our time, we are selling our lives, and our lives are indistinguishable from ourselves. We are selling ourselves, although we're selling it ourselves piecemeal and 40 or 50 hours a week only. Nevertheless, the principle is the same. We are exchanging ourselves for money just as surely as a slave is exchanged for money, just not to the same extent. It's interesting, actually, the psychological effects that ancient thinkers like Aristotle ascribe to slaves, which they see as the product of slavery. These psychological effects are also, I think, characteristic of proletarians. Selling oneself even piecemeal, as a proletarian does for 40 or 50 hours a week, seems to have many of the same psychological effects as slavery is traditionally supposed to have had. Preeminent among these would be materialism. If you read ancient Greek drama or the thought of Aristotle, or treatments of slavery going all the way up to W.E.B. Du Bois in his book The Souls of Black Folks, we find that slaves are associated with sensual pleasure. The only incentives they respond to, allegedly, is sensual pleasure and corporal punishment. In the ancient world, corporal punishment was reserved for slaves because it was felt that they only responded to physical stimuli, whether that was negative or positive. And I think a similar kind of materialist outlook on the world arises in societies like our own, which are characterized by virtually universal wage labor. Like slavery, wage labor seems to produce a materialist outlook on the world, and I think the fact that we live in a society of near universal wage labor goes a long way towards explaining the kind of popular materialism, which I think is the kind of default outlook which most people today have on the world.
I think the word default is a good one there. If you're not actively choosing what you believe, if you're not aware and reflecting about how you want to live your life, then it's very easy in the West. There's an immense corporate interest in handing out predictable consumer worldview. In Bangladesh, I've benefited from seeing another way to live. This is a country where the majority of people still grow their own food. So things work a little bit differently here. For another perspective on Western life, let's hear the following excerpt from episode 638, Modern Human Self-Enslavement, which I subtitled Understanding Addiction to the Consumer Treadmill.
The 1950s saw consumerism come of age. Marketing culture was everywhere. And with the dominance of Hollywood films and the invention of television, it wasn't long before the rest of the world got to witness how comfortable the other half lived.
See it? Isn't it beautiful?
If I only had a car like that, I'd really be popular. Everybody'd want to be friends with me then.
One critical thing that advertising does is it tries to convince consumers that above average products can compensate for below average traits.
Shirt right, tie right, and coat right. Can't be popular unless you know how to dress.
So that if you're not that funny, you're not that verbally creative, you're not artistic, you don't have any of the romantic skills that are naturally attractive, you can compensate, don't worry. You can get the engineering degree, make a respectable living, buy a bunch of stuff, and still be viable and attractive on the mating market. I think that's a delusion. It doesn't actually work.
There's another illustration of the gap between appearance and reality. Let's hear Michael Pollan from episode 516.
We believe that our food is made for us. But the truth is, in every way that matters, we are being made for our food. We are being transformed into the sorts of people living the sorts of rhythms and lives where all of a sudden the most preposterous things become convenient. A McDonald's meal becomes convenient.
Now, if you listen carefully to the following summary from Chris Hedges last episode, I wonder if you can pick up the point which I'm going to dispute.
When capitalism thrives, we are assured we thrive. The merging of the self with a capitalist collective has robbed us of our agency, creativity, capacity for self-reflection, and moral autonomy. We define our worth not by our independence or our character, but by the material standards set by capitalism: wealth, brands, status, career advancement. We have been molded into a compliant and repressed collective. This conformity is characteristic of totalitarian and authoritarian states. It is expressed in the Disneyfication of America, the land of eternally happy thoughts and positive attitudes. And when magical thinking does not work, we are told and often accept that we are the problem. We must have more faith. We must envision what we want. We must try harder. The system is never to blame. We failed it. It does not fail us. And all our systems of information, from self-help gurus to Hollywood, to charlatans such as Trump, sell us this snake oil.
Assuming you got this from the internet, I'm going to venture a small correction to Chris Hedges there. Almost all the corporate capitalist systems are selling snake oil. There's little bits of good everywhere you look, and I'd like to think that this podcast and everything that made it possible will be the exception to the rule. For more on capitalist snake oil, let's hear the following from 502. Is employment compatible with a free society?
The official line is that we all have rights and live in a democracy. Other unfortunates who aren't free like we are have to live in police states. These victims obey orders or else, no matter how arbitrary. The authorities keep them under regular surveillance. State bureaucrats control even the smaller details of everyday life. The officials who push them around are answerable only to higher-ups, public or private. Either way, dissent and disobedience are punished. Informers report regularly to the authorities. All of this is supposed to be a very bad thing. And so it is, although it is nothing but a description of the modern workplace. The liberals and conservatives and libertarians who lament totalitarianism are phonies and hypocrites. There is more freedom in any moderately de-Stalinized dictatorship than there is in the ordinary American workplace. You find the same sort of hierarchy and discipline in an office or factory as you do in a prison or monastery. In fact, Foucault and others have shown, prisons and factories came in at about the same time, and their operators consciously borrowed from each other's control techniques. A worker is a part-time slave. The boss says when to show up, when to leave, and what to do in the meantime. He tells you how much work to do and how fast. He is free to carry his control to humiliating extremes, regulating, if he feels like it, the clothes you wear or how often you go to the bathroom. With a few exceptions, he can fire you for any reason or no reason. He is spied on by snitches and supervisors. He amasses a dossier on every employee.
A short piece on The Moneyless Man, that's by Mark Boyle, which we broadcast in episode 688.
Often I hear people preface their thoughts on right livelihood with, "Of course we all have to make money. We have mortgages to service, bills to pay. There is, after all, a cost of living. We take it for granted that we have to pay merely to be alive." What Mark shows is that this assumption is part of an illusion. While we might, for very good reasons, choose to use money, we may not actually have to. To break free of that illusion requires a profound shift in our perceptions, habits, and core beliefs, a shift in our way of being in the world, even in our sense of self. The monetized life is a life that separates people from community and from nature, channeling our interdependency through an anonymous medium. Money promises that, if only we acquire enough of it, we can be independent. We can be independent of the people around us. I don't need their help. I can pay for whatever I need. We can be independent of the nature around us. If the water is polluted, I can buy it in bottles. If the soil is toxic, I can buy organic food from afar. In the worst case, I can afford to move away. Here, then, is another illusion. We cannot actually achieve independence via money. All we can do is transfer our dependence from one place to another, from the people and places around us to money and the distant institutions it associates us with.
So financial independence is a myth. It's a way of hiding how the money system actually works. I think we all, in our heart of hearts, know that. When people say things like, well, obviously we all have to make money, that's a kind of apology. I suppose it almost relates to original sin. But we won't go down that rabbit hole yet. Let's take a quick music break. We're going to hear a few snatches of The Trader from episode 729.
And neither should you. On the trade floor stands a broker who's a master at the trade, and he's with the biggest brokerage that trades 10 million shares a day in crude oil or in forests or in switch-up factories.
619.
While people are concerned with the harsh austerity measures implemented in many European countries as a consequence of the financial crisis, financial actors are working almost unnoticed towards the submission of nature under their logic. We live in a so-called financialized economy, an economy dominated by finance and financial actors which focus on creating new investment and profit opportunities. The key to do it was the creation of a single global capital market through the abolition of control of movements of capitals by governments, the deregulation of large sectors of the economy, as well as the withdrawal of the state and providing essential services to citizens.
586 on the money system's corrosive effect upon alternative value sets such as morals or laws.
Again and again we have the problem that whether you obey the law or not is a matter of whether it's cost effective. If the chance of getting caught and the penalty are less than it costs to comply, people think of it as being just a business decision.
Every living system of Earth is in decline. Every life support system of Earth is in decline. And these together constitute the biosphere. The biosphere that supports and nurtures all of life, and not just our life, but perhaps 30 million other species that share this planet with us.
Trading money, risk, and associated products has become more profitable and outpaces trading goods and services for capital accumulation. In this financialization process, financial markets and its institutions take control over the productive economy where goods and services are produced, and corporations, households, and banks are transformed to abide by the logic of financial markets by speculating or getting indebted. Instead of financial markets providing money to produce what people need, money is increasingly invested into financial markets to operate and expand. Now, the housing bubble has burst, and the huge sums of money in financial markets are now seeking new investment opportunities. And this is where nature comes into the picture. About making profits with nature, we know already the role of financial players investing in mines, oil fields, or agricultural activities, or purchasing cargoes of raw materials by playing on price trends or derivative markets. But the financialization of nature currently at work is a much deeper process. Back in 2005, the EU introduced the so-called Emission Trading Scheme, ETS, with the argument to reduce carbon emissions. In this scheme, companies are given a maximum of rights in the form of emission certificates to pollute the air with CO2. As the certificates can be traded between companies, financial markets were created and CO2 made a financial asset. This has created a profit opportunity for many companies and financial actors.
And he can make you rich as Midas if you just can get a piece. Bye, bye, bye. Let the others work for you. Bye, bye, bye. Just watch the numbers on the screen as they go high.
Come on, gentlemen, we got bankers.
Buying and selling emission certificates. EU economies continue to produce in an unsustainable and polluting way above the limits that the planet can support, rather than reducing their own emissions. The same proposals are being made for forests, biodiversity, or ecosystems, and all the ecological functions that could provide a service to humanity. To submit nature under the logic of financial markets requires to define what nature does as environmental service. So the tree's capacity to capture carbon, the decomposition of waste, water purification, and regulation of the climate is now defined, normalized, quantified, and certified as an environmental service. Once this is done, you can start placing a price tag to each service, evaluate their current status, state a limit, and concretize in economic terms the cost of their conservation in order to develop a market for each particular environmental service. With new property rights, a new phase of enclosures and extraction of natural resources and biodiversity, grabbing is taking place. So people are kicked off their lands, communities and nature are destroyed, and the global south becomes the loser. All those engaged in this green economy and financial markets become the winners.
And now he's moving capital all around the world, and he's trading things you never would imagine, and you can't believe our bodden sold like water and like clean air and like molecules and genes, till our very lives are traded and our earth is desecrated, and it all goes just to fund a rich man's schemes.
690 on Red, the World Bank's Forest Protection Racket.
The idea is that countries and even companies and industries in the global north would invest financial resources into countries and agencies in the global south to keep their forests standing, basically pay cash money to not chop the forest down. In exchange, those countries then are generating carbon credits, which can then be traded to companies in the global north to essentially continue polluting. And this is one of the big problems with RED. You're taking forests, which are a complex ecosystem and a kind of a commons, a dynamic natural environment, and you're turning it into a commodity. And so you're essentially limiting the meaning of what a forest is by paying for it. Another problem being that the people that actually own and control the forests are not the people that tend to protect the forests. So the money from RED will go to states, will go to corporations, and will flow back to the same corporations in allowing them to continue polluting in the global north.
So the guardians of a forest, say in Mexico, they, under this scheme, would get a certain amount of money and also carbon credits that they would then sell or trade to polluters in other countries?
Exactly.
Lies, lies, lies. They said capital would free us. Lies, lies, lies. While the brokers take their cut, the planet dies. Lies, lies,
Robert Zolik
lies, lies,
received
lies,
rousing
lies,
applause when he said that RED is the best chance and perhaps the last chance to save the world's forests. Now, sitting there and listening to that, I'm hearing it not as a forest protection scheme, but as a forest protection racket. This is, you know, the World Bank, the leading investor in fossil fuel development and in global environmental destruction, saying, you know, it would be a shame if something happened to the rest of the world's forests, so put them under our control and we'll protect them for you, essentially. So the World Bank has a project called the Global Forest Carbon Facility, which is dedicated to promoting RED. In fact, BP, the oil company responsible for the Gulf spill, was the first investor in the World Bank's Forest Carbon Facility. So the World Bank is there. You have the United Nations, of course, and then you have a whole list of market-minded conservation or environmental organizations, from Conservation International, Environmental Defense, the Nature Conservancy, Natural Resources Defense Council, all of the environmental organizations that tend to believe that the market can get us out of the environmental and social mess that we've gotten ourselves into. a lot of well-intentioned people, a lot of, liberal, even progressive NGOs tend to go for it, which is part of why I've been doing the work and a lot of other, organizations and people have been doing the work of digging up the details, because the devil is really in the details. When you pay to protect the forest, it sets in motion a whole number of potentially abusive, corrupt, and corrosive practices.
As an antidote to thinking of the real world in money terms, let's hear Lynn Gary from episode 44.
Though they'd like you to believe otherwise, capitalists and their capital actually contribute nothing of much use to the economy or the well-being of most people. Rather, in most cases, they take away from the resources that other people might share and use. Capital flight, the removal of capitalists and their resources from a country's economy, is often used as a threat against governments or groups who want to change conditions in a country so that there is real democracy, in other words, a nation or group that functions for the benefit of the majority of its citizens. This is an interesting article by John Yu, which was published on www.infoshop.org. It's called Capital Flight, What to Do. You've just overthrown the government. Your far-left party has just won a landslide election. Or your vast coalition of civic, labor, and religious institutions have simply decided to come together and ignore the existing government. Capitalists are fleeing your country in their private jets. Investors have pulled out all their money. Foreign banks run by capitalists suddenly decide they are no longer willing to make any loans to your rogue nation. The former dictator has packed up all his suitcases full of gold, jewels, and cash from your national treasury and is nowhere to be found. Now what? Economic collapse? Mass unemployment? Depression and starvation? No, of course not. Wealth is not to be found in currency, in the so-called precious metals, in paintings by long-dead painters. None of these are needed to survive.
Money, that soulless, empty, arbitrary concept, subject to the fickle whims of markets and inflation, in itself good for neither feeding us, sheltering us, nor loving us, has become more meaningful, more valued, and more sacred in our lives than trees, providers of oxygen, water, food, shade, shelter, and soil structure. We are in Alice's Wonderland, where nothing is what it seems, and nothing is as it should be.
Some more heresy from Derek Jensen, episode 201.
There are no rich people in the world, and there are no poor people. There are just people. The rich may have lots of pieces of paper that many pretend are worth something, and the poor may not. The rich claim they own land, and the poor are denied the right to make the same claim. A primary purpose of the police is to enforce the delusions of those with lots of pieces of green paper. Those without the green papers generally buy into these delusions almost as quickly and completely as those with. These delusions carry with them extreme consequences in the real world.
We are completely delusional about what we need in order to live nourished, meaningful lives, and our delusion is destroying not only our ability to do that, but the ability of every other species on the planet to do so too. As the Cree Indian proverb goes, it seems that only when the last tree has died, the last river been poisoned, and the last fish been caught, will we realize we cannot eat money.
Wealth is found in food, in warmth, in health care, and in the things necessary to produce them. All the land is still yours. All the labor is still yours. Even factory equipment remains, despite the flight of capital, that is, the loss of things that represent wealth, but are not wealth themselves. In fact, very little has been lost, and virtually all of the productive capacity of your nation remains. All that has changed is the accounting.